Welcome to Biocompatibility, the first ever podcast focused on the biocompatibility of medical devices. NAMSA is happy to bring biocompatibility to you, where each episode features leading industry experts and their discussions on biocompatibility challenges. Be sure to visit www.namsa.com for more information and to access all podcasts and transcripts. We hope you enjoyed today's episode.
Welcome to another episode of Biocompatibility. It's just Dawn and me today.
Just it is.
The OGs, Biocompatibility.
Yep. But hey, we're back for another episode.
And you we're back for another episode.
Didn't have to wait like a year.
You know? Hopefully so. Not. Well, you're assuming I get this all edited and posted out there. The recording is just the one part.
Recording is the first step in the process. So hey.
Yeah. So Dawn and I had the opportunity to be together a couple of weeks ago with some regulatory folks from a regulatory body. And one of the topics that Dawn and I started chatting about, I don't know if it was before, during, after, was early feasibility studies in the U.S. kind of in particular for, so the definition of what you perceive as an early feasibility study, I guess, is that's that initial trial in a human, but it could be very, very small. Is that
usually less than 10 patients, I think, how it gets described.
Usually less than 10 is how it gets described. Okay.
Yeah. And you know, that from what it's called type thing, partially, you know, from an FDA perspective, they have this draft or they have this guidance out there on early feasibility studies, but its title kind of links a couple different names together. So IDEs for early feasibility medical device clinical studies, including certain first in human studies, and that name first in human often gets thrown around outside the United States.
That's all the buzzwords right there.
All just crammed in together.
It's like they were looking for search engine optimization. They got all the buzzwords right there in the title.
Exactly. And we might have to push pause here for just a second, because Sherry and I are not going to talk about regulatory requirements for early feasibility studies.
Very good. Very good point. Yes. We do
we'll
not
let that
know
for somebody else's podcast.
Right. Yeah, we'll direct you to our colleagues over at the RAQA podcast and see if they might be able to help you out there. But yeah, we're looking at the burden of biological safety for these types of instances, because as you mentioned, there's an old draft out there. It doesn't say much. And, you know, part one or 10993 or the FDA guidance doesn't ever determine when, you know, that evaluation is to be completed in its full. So I think, you know, it's just a topic that it's gray, and boy, aren't those gray topics. They're the fun ones to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, it just raises the question, how much biocompatibility do I have to do to protect 10 people?
Less than 10 people.
Yeah. Which sounds really terrible.
I don't like thinking about it that way. It sounds terrible for those 10 people. Again, these would all be like IDE PMA products. So these are all going to be probably many of them life-saving efforts. Well, I guess not life-saving. They could be other types of implants, but a lot of them are.
Yeah, and it does. And right there, I know we just said it kind of makes us squirm to say just those 10 people, like they are not important, but right there is like one advantage that this whole situation offers, that later steps in the regulatory process will not offer. And that is, you have less than 10 people and you have to control the response to your device in just those 10 people.
Right.
And in at least in the United States, well, and I'll say maybe not as much evidence from my point of view, but across other regions too, in the EU, Israel, you know, the control measure of just having a few patients is definitely used as a reason why, in part, biocompatibility doesn't need to be as extensive as it needs to be for a pivotal where you have hundreds of people, and commercialization where you lose practically all control because now it's out on the market and you can't respond to protecting all those people the way you can in a really, really, really small clinical first in human early feasibility type study. So we definitely take, or I've seen situations where that risk control measure is used to help address biocompatibility in ways that, you know, are definitely, you know, risk management principles put into play, probably more so than what you see risk management in other areas, quite honestly, where you feel like you're doing testing just because there's a table that tells you to do testing. Right. Here, you have the opportunity to spell things out a little bit better and put plans together that support the concept that you're fairly confident that these people are going to be safe following the exposure of this device. So it's definitely, I think it's one of the cool areas of biocompatibility because you actually create plans that allow you to be a little bit more creative than what the other areas do in some cases.
I think that's the word for me that is certainly triggering my thoughts is plan.
Yeah.
So when I'm starting with a product and we preach to folks that your biological safety plan, your biological evaluation plan, whatever, however you want to label it in your system, is not a one and done type of document. It's something you start at the beginning when you're selecting materials. So yeah. I'm looking at my plan and, okay, I know I have an early feasibility coming. When I'm selecting my materials, I want to make sure I'm choosing materials that I can support in my plan that I know have a general knowledge of safety. And it could be some class 6 testing. It could be some previous 10993 testing. But that comes into play when I'm creating my plan that I'm choosing safe materials to hopefully lessen my burden on what I would have to do to get into my early feasibility. And then as I go along, I get to add to it, adjust it. I had a experience. I was talking to somebody about a plan, how they change and grow. And this person refers to it like it's like a baby book. And I was like, that's perfect. It is absolutely like a baby book because as it grows and as it changes, you're going to update your plan. You're going to modify your plan. It's going to have different purposes. So when you go to, and I can't believe I'm talking this much, but I just had a brilliant this is brilliant thoughts coming to me. I have to get them out. But when you go to like a Dawn or a NAMSA or another consultant who's helping to guide you, when they want to know why are we doing this biological evaluation? This is a key reason because your level of burden is different at different phases. Yeah, is that a brilliant thought that just came to me?
It's a perfect example of like the living, breathing evaluation plan type thing.
Yep.
You know, it grows as your device grows, if you will, from a regulatory point of view, if you will. And, you know, the risk management, risk control measures kind of grow and change and morph as you go along the way too. And it's, you know, like even just the simplest things, like the scope of your biocompatibility plan for early feasibility. I mean, one of the key things is defining the scope. This plan is for what? It's for early feasibility. And that's it. And then after you get done with that, assuming everything goes well and you're getting ready for pivotal, now you can change the scope. You can write a new version of the document, change the scope to this plan is to support pivotal. And then version 3, this plan is to support PMA, commercialization, wherever it might be. And then, you know, it's a perfect example of how these documents aren't meant to be a one and done type thing, which I know we've preached over and over again, but you know, this is an easy example of how it grows and morphs. And some might say, well, how's your plan going to change? Because it's still biocomp. If you're a permanent cardiovascular implant, you still got to do the same stuff. And, you know, historically speaking, you know, I look back 20 years ago, and if somebody called me up for a biocomp quote and said, hey, yeah, I'm just trying to do a first in human study. That's all I'm doing. What testing would you recommend? Because back in the day, that's how it was done.
That's all they wanted to know. Yeah.
And the plan was hatched by a biocomp quote being written. You know, our typical response might be, well, it doesn't really matter. You got to, it's biocomp. It's the same exposure, you know, but now today's world, it does matter in terms of that scope, but it requires a plan. And, you know, I've seen for early feasibility in first in human, however you want to call it, whatever you want to call it, you definitely have this reliance on material selection. Like you said, Sherry, it's going to be, you know, you're going to address some endpoints likely by selection of safe materials of construction and manufacture. But, you know, it's one thing to say that and have it in a table. My plan, I'm not doing genotox testing because I'm selecting safe materials of construction. I mean, it's great to say that. But then now, in my opinion, that concept gets supported by an appendix that dives into the materials of construction and the fact that you define what's known about them from biocompatibility and materials of construction, I mean, manufacture. So, you know, they still has all the mechanics, if you will, there, but that might be as far as you take your characterization process. You just at a qualitative material level. I haven't seen chemical characterization in terms of testing, extractables testing being done for an early feasibility first in human study. I mean, I just kind of cringe at the thought of doing it.
And one of the things, you know, it's in the words, it's early feasibility, that there's likely, or I don't know, likely, maybe that's not the best choice of word, but there's certainly an opportunity that after you learn something in your early feasibility, that something may change. And that's why, you know, I think it makes sense to know what you're trying to accomplish in your evaluation strategy from the get-go. And starting it here hopefully prevents you from getting to the end and going, uh-oh, did we do all those biocomp tests that we have to do?
Because
it still happens.
You've got to sort of, I mean, in typical fashion here, again, there's no specific guidance that tells you what you have to do in terms of testing and what you don't. But the concept is you're going to creep up on everything. Like, you know, you'll do some biocomp for early feasibility.
We're not saying you don't have to do anything, right? Yeah. Yes. We certainly want to make that clear.
Be prepared for things like, you know, like cytosensitization, irritation. You're going to factor into it materials of construction, but then you're also going to factor into it a well-designed animal study more than likely as well, because as Sherry said, these are all usually high-risk devices.
Yeah.
And don't be surprised if you have a delivery system and an implant that in terms of actual biocomp testing, there's a chance you might do more testing biocomp-wise on the delivery system maybe than you did on the actual implant. I mean... Mm-hmm. Maybe not. Maybe they're the same. And it'll seem weird because when you end at commercialization, they're going to be worlds apart in terms of the amount of testing that you do, more than likely. But, you know, they're going to start probably in a similar fashion in some cases and not really diverge until you get further on to your big clinical study after the first phase. And once you get to the big clinical study, biocomp starts to get a little bit real. But now you also have to factor in, if I did cytosensitization and irritation testing for early feasibility, can or can I not use those three tests for my pivotal? Because you're going to have to look back and see, okay, what did people tell me I had to change about my device because of functional feedback, whatever I had, or didn't they, you know? And now you're talking about equivalency there to figure out even for those three studies if you have to change something.
Right.
But again, that's when I say that you're kind of creeping up on biocomp. You know, there's situations where I've seen pivotal as the next step in the process still not need chemical characterization testing. And some people might be surprised at that for pivotal. Now, it depends on the other test, and you're going to have some data that you're going to have to fill some holes with. But especially in the United States, that might not be the chemical characterization solution to the problem. You might hold that off until PMA in some situations, not in all, but there's a possibility for it to work out that way. So yeah, there's a lot of gray areas. And again, all the stuff that I'm talking about, to my knowledge, the specifics aren't written down anywhere. So you just So, yeah, you definitely want to team up with somebody that maybe has been there. I'd say the concept, the process that I've seen most well-defined, or type of product that is most well-defined for, is cardiovascular implants.
Cardiovascular implants, yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I think, I don't know, it's probably a real generalization, but I'm guessing of all the clinicals that are being run out there, probably a majority of them are cardio. When you look at medical devices, I think that's probably a lot of clinicals that get run in that area. So it would make sense that they would have potentially some sort of idea on the strategy for biological safety to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the high risk devices, all these, you know, these devices are always going to have, you know, animal studies that are performed up front to prove efficacy, but then also safety. And then you're going to start putting more into those studies, the more you want to use them for something else like biocompatibility. And that's, you know, a key aspect right there is designing that animal study to not only get you the performance and efficacy data that you want, but also, you know, to address things like part 6 and part 4 and, you know, maybe even aspects where you can. Of part 11.
Yep. You know?
So it's and the nice thing is taking the time to do that is worth it because you get reward out of it. You actually like it actually works type thing.
It actually works. Yeah.
If you do it properly. And in the United States, that along the way, you know, you're being supported, more than likely supported by the pre-sub process and kind of vetting your thoughts and plans with, you know, FDA in that case to figure out what you have to do and where you need to go and this, that, and the other thing. But even I'd say outside the United States, the concept that we're talking about, I think still comes into play, you know,
certainly
having a plan
true.
With a scope that's
so.
For first in human, and you're still supporting your materials, your manufacturing process in the same way. And because again, you're exposing a few people, you know, there's risk control measures by virtue of that, you know, number of patients that you kind of used in your favor. And, you know, your scope of what you need to do testing wise typically is minimized quite a bit at that stage in the game. And, you know, but you got to just be prepared for things, yes. as I say, to get real later on because they're going to.
Yes. It's not any false sense of security there, but it, again, I like that there's thought around it. It's there's some logic around it that while we want new innovation, obviously that's our goal, all of us to help get new innovation out there to improve healthcare worldwide. And by doing this in a way that allows us to get into those early feasibility studies without unnecessarily delays, I mean, I think it shows that there's that effort, there's that commitment to new technology and innovation in this industry.
Yeah. And that's that, you know, you mentioned one thing there, maybe think of one more thing that plays in your advantage is risk benefit becomes a little bit more well-defined here in a lot of cases, because again, you're probably dealing with people in the world that have a condition that there's not a treatment for, or not the best treatment for. So somebody came up with a better solution to the problem, or the first solution to the problem.
Right. Yeah. It could be the first of its kind. Yeah.
And so now if there's people whose lives you literally can save by getting this device out there, and you don't have to use a device off label and kind of contort it into working for what you want it to do.
Right.
You know, the benefit definitely, you know, is a bit more obvious.
Excellent. Yeah, I think this was I think it was a good topic. I think it was something that wasn't anything that we'd had on a list of things that, we need to talk about that someday. It just kind of happened and we're like, let's talk about it again and record it and put it out there because, you can't find the answers really in a book or online necessarily.
Yeah.
I don't know that answered anything, but we gave you some thoughts.
Yeah, and I know there's things that are in progress right now being developed to try to make this concept, well, at least I don't know if I'd call it guidance, but give some thoughts, some instruction on what to think about for this type of situation, just so people realize that, you know, I'd hate for companies that are getting ready for an early feasibility or something like that to like start testing, because that's what a lot of people do. They think, plan, and execute all on Monday, and then Friday rolls around and they realize what they did on Monday, they didn't need to do, or what they started on Monday, they didn't need to. So, you know, just keep it in mind, you know, this is a little bit different in some situations than what it is if you are going to release your device on the world because you're a 510K and, you know, you're going out there and commercialization right from the get-go. Some devices aren't that way, obviously.
When Don or somebody like him says, you know, what's your why? Where are we at here? Why are we doing this? There's lots of reasons around that. And when sales folks come to me, even within NAMSA's organization, and we talk about different things and getting information from customers, I always encourage them that the first thing to learn is the why. We can't solve for nothing. We need to know what we're trying to solve for. And usually it's why we're talking about this. This is a solution. Why is testing the solution here? How did we get here? And is it the right solution? So good. Yeah, I like this, Don. Good stuff.
Good stuff. Now we just got to think of one more, another topic to keep this.
Just one more? We only need one more.
Sure.
Yeah, we're on a roll.
Just let's to keep this ball rolling. We got to keep going.
We'll try to keep the ball rolling this year. It's good. I'm glad when we make time to do this, because I really do. I learn a lot, and I hope other people do. I think they do. We always get some feedback from folks. So thank you again, Don, and thanks you all. Thank you all. Thanks you all. Thanks to everybody for listening and hanging in there and waiting for new episodes and enjoying them, hopefully, when they come out.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy Biocompatibility, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast store. For free resources and material, remember to visit www.namsa.com/resources/podcast.